Don Jones. I have come to think of the doing of art as a sacramental activity, perhaps because I am witness to the gradual desacralization of the world. Art activity is my grounding, my space, my resource to cope with stress and chaos when life, nature, human relationships all are profaned. Art's role in healing is a sacred endeavor for me and an obligation. So, celebrate the arts with me. Let us sing for singing and dance for dancing. This is our gratitude, being creatures fashioned of delight and enabled with passion. Forms and shapes are insight and wisdom. We bring beauty from the mating of mind and emotion. The images of our inner landscapes are unknown, unique, and graceful creatures. Our arts are keys to doors, wings for flying. Poems are feet for running on new paths through valleys of questions. Our paintbrushes are lightning, opening our souls to see the awesome. Sculpture reveals secrets in the fullness of alternating sunlight and shadow. Dancing is a story of a dream, the dancer a lively imagination. Plays and stories invent a history of people in uncreated worlds. Music's voice sings a greeting from the heart. Come walk with me on this aesthetic journey to art's hidden places. Listen to my song. The melody will sound to you of more than your mind can remember, or my brain knows how to tell.
And good morning to you. Yes, Don, wherever you are.
There you are.
Yes, Don, this Sunday service is indeed a celebration. A celebration of our capacity to be the makers of every kind of expressive medium inherent in our human abilities and also in our spiritual awareness. Now come back with me to this hymn 123. I'd like to guide you with the help of your imagination. We all have one. In that part of our brain which gives us pictures, colors, actions, and images. The goal here is to enrich and make deeper this hymn, which is perhaps in some ways almost too familiar, in which we do not really pay attention to what the words are saying. I invite you to relax, to sit back, possible to clear your lap of whatever you might have there, not the children. And let me be the talking voice which invites your inner TV screen, your movie-making mind. You are the director. I'll speak those familiar words of this hymn slowly and with pauses. And your job is to invite and stay open to what pictures, colors, and actions your wonderful imagination gives you as I am reading the words. So now I ask you, Turn on the TV screen of your mind. Please close your eyes and be aware with your imagination these words. Spirit of life, come to me, come to me. Sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion. Blow in the wind and rise in the sea. Move in the hand, giving life the shape of justice. Roots, hold me close. Wind, set me free. Spirit of life, come to me. Come to me. And please keep your eyes closed and see what images remain. Thank you. Now I ask you to open your eyes, and will you, with someone near you, share something of this adventure with our words, imagination, in our wonderful mind, our creative mind. Please share with each other. And you may want to continue this conversation and sharing after the service in Fellowship Hall. Thank you so much.
Please rise as willing and able and remain standing through the hymn. Turn in your order of celebration to the section on affirmation, which we will read together shortly.
Good morning. I'm Judy Fettman, and one of my art forms is photography. From the time I was a little girl, I was fascinated by photographs of sunrises, sunsets, mountains, clouds. I ripped out pictures of colorful landscapes from Ideals magazine and taped them into my scrapbook. My father often took my brothers and me on Sunday afternoon rides in the country and took our pictures in front of brilliant autumn trees or sitting upon a huge rock. I often protested, but secretly, I was filing away in my mind those brilliant images of nature's splendor. At age 10, when I was given a camera of my own, I began capturing my own moments with nature. And now that I have the time to return to that childhood interest, I find inspiration for my photographic creativity in my awareness of the beauty and power of nature. Rachel Carson wrote, "Those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life." Let me tell you a story. I was feeling sluggish and depressed one December morning and had trouble getting out of bed. As I headed for the coffee maker, I noticed the sun peeking out from behind the clouds. I opened the kitchen window and found it exceptionally mild for December. A buck stood staring at me like some stationary yard ornament in the grassy hill above the deck. Neither of us moved. Our eyes remained locked until he was bored or hungry and moved on. Then I noticed the thick fog. The live oaks receded and eventually disappeared in the mist, creating layers of trees one upon the other. The first of the winter rains had allowed tender young shoots of grass to grow thick beneath the branches. December in California felt like spring in Michigan, and I began to remember why I had wanted to move west. Something bright in a tree caught my eye. Between two leafy branches, a spider had spun a perfect plate-sized web. The low morning sun was glistening on each fine strand of the web, the spokes of a perfect wheel, connected by innumerable filaments, each one glowing with a light against the dark, foggy trees. Slowly, I began to take in this miracle of the morning. After gazing at it in wonder for some time, I thought, someone should take a picture of this. I tried to remember where I had my camera. Downstairs. I didn't feel like going downstairs and up again, and besides, the camera probably wouldn't work. The batteries were low. Nevertheless, I found the camera, climbed upstairs once more. I pulled a chair over to the window, threw off my bathrobe, and climbed higher onto the counter, kneeling before the open kitchen window. The web was still glowing there against fog, its fine elastic threads trembling in the breeze. Probably won't come out, I grumbled to myself as I snapped the shutter. But as I sipped my coffee, I couldn't quite let go of that amazing scene. I stepped on the camera again to see if I had caught anything, and there on my 1-by-2-inch screen, I could make out the fog and the dark trees and a white blob. Curiosity led me to my computer for a better look. On my screen appeared the foggy trees, and between the branches, that perfect sparkling web. I felt the stirrings of excitement rising within me. Here was the picture of Christmas in California, the sun, the warmth, the live oaks that do not lose their leaves, and spider webs as ornaments. Pure joy stirred in me. The photo conveyed that sense of awe I had finally felt at the sun shining down in a new day. And with gratitude, I thanked Mother Nature, or whomever, who had indeed presented me with peace and delight. All I had to do to see it was to open my eyes. Our UU sources include direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder, which moves us to renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life, and spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions, which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. In the UU Visual Artists Group and in the Artist's Way course here at First Church, I have found important support for my own developing art. Photography has made me look closely, has developed in me a creative awareness of nature that surrounds me. As photographer Paula Chamley writes, I love looking at the world. There is so much to learn from looking. I see the world as if it were one continuous canvas, a constantly unfolding painting. And I stop now and then to selectively put edges around parts of it.
As a poet and teacher of poetic technique in college and community workshops, I often explain in the first class or first few minutes of a workshop what seems a harsh approach to the work that these aspiring poets might produce. I explain to them that if their view is that poetry is a vehicle for expressing their feelings, they're about to be disappointed in me because I tell them directly, I don't care about your feelings. Now, that might appear to be a bad beginning, but I move quickly to try to remove those shocked and disappointed looks from their faces. I note that although their feelings, their emotional responses to the world and their experience of it are central to creative expression, they can't expect me to understand what they mean when they say they experienced love or pain or loneliness. My pain and loneliness are different from theirs. They understand better when I point out the difference between what women and men can mean when they say love. When a guy says, I love you, baby, he probably means something very different than what most women mean when they say it. And they often respond, you don't love me, I know what you mean. If you love me, you'd, and then there's a little list of ways that he can show his love. So this brings to mind the concept of representation. What represents longing, for example, or what represents joy? Poet Ezra Pound said, "Go in fear of abstraction." And the poet William Carlos Williams' primary statement of his own approach to poetry was direct. No ideas, but in things. That is, poets, and there is a poet inside each of us, must use the things of the world to convey something intangible, our highly personal reactions to our world and our lives in it. There's no way to effectively convey emotion except in terms of the things of the world, physical objects, expressive verbs, the reactions those things evoke. Each of us understands how our own emotions make us feel, but we cannot assume that what we feel is the same as what anybody else feels. The poet Marvin Bell took a stab at this defining of poetry and how it works, and one statement he came up with was, "What people say there are no words for, that's what poetry's for." That is, poetry seeks not to explain what is, but to suggest a connection that exists not above the neck, but in the chest or in the gut. Although poetry employs the intellect, it is not as much an intellectual process as it is one that demands that we leap beyond the literal into the figurative or the associative. The awareness produced by the best poetry taps into our sense of things rather than the meaning of them. Poetry provides a way to express how the world is to an individual writer or to ourselves. And if that resonates with others, so much the better. Most of our art, in many ways, is produced for ourselves, and the gravy is that other people somehow take something from it. We're all familiar with the basics of this awareness, similes that allow us to convey the unfamiliar in terms of something familiar, the river twisted like a dark snake through the hills, or metaphors that convey the same comparison as if it's fact, the river was a dark snake snaking through the hills, or the implied metaphor of the dark river snaked between the hills, or personification that uses human actions to express the workings of the animal or the inanimate world. And with such comparisons, unstated associations arise. The river was a dark snake. Does not directly state that the speaker found the river threatening or menacing, but allows it to be suggested just below the surface, as it were. So we become aware of an enlarged awareness, not so much of what the world can tell us, but what it can suggest to us through, as poet Jennifer Bosveld, a member of this congregation, has phrased it, making words dance together that never danced together before. Another of poet Marvin Bell's efforts at explaining how poetry works on our awareness states, prose is prose because of what it includes. Poetry is poetry because of what it leaves out. A poetic awareness allows us to fill in those spaces with our own reactions to an enhanced awareness of the world. This awareness is an expansive one, one that enhances our capacity for ambiguity, for multiple and possible conflicting responses to images or our own emotions. This allowance for ambiguity in poetry sweeps away a dualistic approach to our thinking. It opens us to a world that is not either black or white, but is both black and white, to emotions that are not either loving or resentful, but that are both loving and resentful at various times. And in this way, we become more aware of our capacity for nuance, for empathy, for compassion. As we practice such awareness, we begin to appreciate the interconnectedness our subconscious, our mind's eye, creates from the things of the world and behaviors of ourselves and others. These non-literal, non-linear ways of seeing are fully in tune with the seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism. Respect for the interconnected web of all existence. In allowing ourselves to explore these connections, we tap into a way of thinking and seeing and feeling that captures our own unique and highly personal ways of interpreting the universe. A poetic awareness allows us to understand, without being able to fully put it into words, why the wind-driven movement of trees in full leaf or stripped bare in winter brings to mind the silent applause of upraised hands by a deaf audience that we sometimes use in our services here. It allows us to know what an immigrant student meant when he wrote, "I went outside and smoked down my anger." Poetic awareness allows us to share the emotion of our own feelings expressed by the poet who wrote, "You touched me the way an autumn leaf sets the sky afire."
Despite her distinguished theater family, Agnes B. DeMille's uncle was Cecil B. DeMille. Agnes DeMille had for many years a struggle and failures in trying to become a dancer and choreographer. After one of her ballets failed, the great American choreographer and dancer Martha Graham wrote this letter of encouragement. It has become a mainstay, often quoted, of artist inspirational literature. There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And there is only one of you in all time. This expression is unique, and if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, how it compares with other expression. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open.
The second reading is taken from an essay, In the Eye of the Artist, by Ken Wilber, a contemporary integral philosopher, author, and Buddhist. The secret of all genuinely spiritual works of art is that they issue from non-dual or unity consciousness, no matter what objects they portray. A painting does not have to depict crosses and Buddhas to be spiritual. This is why, for example, Zen landscapes are so profoundly sacred in their texture, even if they are just landscapes. They issue from a non-dual awareness or unity consciousness, which is itself spirit. At the height of transcendence, spirit is also purely immanent and all-pervading, present equally and totally in each and every object, whether of matter, body, mind, or soul. The artwork of no matter what the object becomes transparent to the divine and is a direct expression of spirit. Wilber quotes a source in Eastern philosophy, "He who cannot become an object cannot paint that object."
Hi, I'm Tom Balliol, scientist and also a member of the visual arts group here. And somehow it always seems to fall to me to cover the entire span of human history in 6 minutes. So hold on to your hats. Spirituality and creativity. Look around you at our community, our nation, our world, at buildings and bridges, galleries and restaurants, museums and music halls. We humans are a creative lot. And in our creativity, we have brought into existence thousands of distinct religions. So far as we can tell, we are the only species that discusses matters spiritual and perceives beauty. Spirituality and creativity are two sides of the same coin. They both arise from an ability to think and communicate symbolically and to imagine things not yet present. Yet how is it that we came to possess these traits? It turns out that, like all human characteristics, our creative and spiritual sides have their origins deep in our biological ancestry. Our behaviors are different in magnitude and degree from other species, but not in kind. Consider those animal species that share with us an awareness of self. Dolphins have brain-to-body mass ratios on par with humans and are known to exhibit interspecies altruism. However, dolphins don't make art. Whale song can be heard over vast distances, but the meanings of these ever-changing vocalizations are beyond human understanding. Elephants have been observed to display apparent grief over the death of a family member, a precursor of moral thought. Some zoo elephants also enjoy brushing bright colors onto large canvases. Chimp groups in the wild use up to 20 different types of tools for various functions of daily life, including sociality, subsistence, self-maintenance, and sex. Chimpanzees create in a social context and have been shown to have a sense of humor and to transfer cultural knowledge. Further, chimps in the wild will respond to a thunderstorm the way they would to an animal predator, such as a leopard. In other words, they assign an animate purpose to the storm, different from their reaction to, say, a wildfire. This is the beginning of religious thought. Still, to the extent that we can put ourselves into the minds of other species through observation of their physical behaviors, no other animals appear to ponder their origins, the meaning of life, or the existence of the divine. It's very difficult to pinpoint the precise moment when human beings began to express imagination and to reason symbolically. Prior to the development of writing, our knowledge of the earliest humans is limited to durable materials such as stone and bone. The physical evidences for the existence of a symbolic and thus potentially spiritual culture include cave paintings, rock engravings, personal ornamentation, decorated tools, the use of natural pigments, engraved bones and stones, burials with grave goods, systems of notation, musical instruments, and complex bone and wood technologies. There are hints that species ancestral to modern humans may have had the capacity for complex communication and imagination, and brain size appears to be the key. At a 400,000-year-old site in Zambia, associated with a large-brained human ancestor known as Homo heidelbergensis, archaeologists discovered 300 lumps of ochre and other pigments, yellow, pink, red, purple, brown, and blue-black, some gathered far from the site. Now, ochre can be used as the binding agent for attaching stone points to wooden shafts, but for this use, one color is sufficient. Why collect a range of colors? Heidelbergensis also has been associated with an 8-step manufacturing process for wooden spears and with a change in the quality of craftsmanship of stone tools, moving from just simply utilitarian to tools of striking symmetry, suggesting an aesthetic sense that far in the past. From Neanderthal sites in Europe dated to 30,000 and 40,000 years ago, a time when our own species was present, comes evidence of body ornamentation in the form of shell and bone beads, complex tool making, ritual burials, and the creation of musical instruments. Clearly, these were people capable of symbolic reasoning and practice, of making music, and of questioning the meaning of death. Yet evidence from their habitation site suggests that Neanderthal thought processes were very different from modern humans. Our immediate ancestors, anatomically modern humans, arose in Africa somewhere between 160,000 and 200,000 years ago, and their remains have been found in the Levant, dated to around 100,000 years ago. However, the Levant Homo sapiens sites do not show cultural remains any more sophisticated than the nearby Neanderthal sites. It's in sites in southern Africa dating to around 75,000 years ago that we start seeing objects associated with modern humans which strongly suggest a new way of thinking about themselves and the world around them. From the Blombos Cave on the Cape Coast of South Africa comes a set of worn shell beads indicating an interest in bodily adornment. And also from this site comes the first known human artwork, a piece of ochre engraved with a geometric linear pattern. In a time span covering the next 40,000 years and from sites throughout Africa, the Middle East, Australia, and Europe, archaeologists have uncovered an increasing treasure trove of artifacts, demonstrating that early Homo sapiens possessed self-awareness, imagination, abstract thinking, and the ability to communicate symbolically. By 35,000 years ago, art and spiritual expression were in full swing in Europe, Africa, and Australia. Cave paintings and rock engravings of both realistic images and fantastical creatures, part animal, part human, are evidence of fully modern imaginative abilities and of religious expression. This is what separates humans from all other species on the planet today. Our ancestors created art, bodily adornment, music, stone tools with aesthetics rather than utility in mind, and also complex social structures. They buried their dead with care and placed in these graves food, jewelry, and weapons, strongly suggesting a belief in an afterlife. As anthropologist Ian Tattersall points out, only modern humans have the demonstrated ability to divide up the world around them into a huge number of discrete elements and then to name those elements. This allows us to rearrange those elements in our minds and imagine a variety of different realities. How did this ability come about? Tattersall believes that it arose as Homo sapiens began to express an understanding of the world in ever more complex language. Language, words, and syntax is the mechanism of our conscious thoughts. Try thinking deeply about something without thinking in words. Spirituality and creativity, symbolic thought, and the ability to ask the great questions. We are the species that not only thinks about ourselves and our relation to the universe around us, but expresses our understandings and imaginings in a myriad of ways. So embrace your humanity, go forth, ask questions, seek answers, and create beauty.
I never imagined when I chose art as a retirement hobby that it would become my spiritual journey. At first, I naturally thought about images I wished to portray, about the materials to use, and about the romantic image of myself with a brush in the hand before the easel, maybe a beret also. But experiences and creativity, reading and contact with others brought realization that the images were not the things I'd be painting. For painting was not the challenge. It was seeing into a deeper reality, a reality never seen before by my eyes. And true seeing came only from a heightened awareness of reality. William Blake said, "He who does not imagine in stronger and better lineaments and in stronger and better light than his perishing and mortal eye can see, does not imagine at all." At a time in life when I expected to become less engaged in the world, I found myself falling in love with the world, becoming entranced through creative awareness. I knew from 40 years of museum going that looking at art made me see things much differently. Looking at people, I recognized qualities I'd seen in portraits. Looking at nature, I saw it as though it was a landscape by a favorite painter. Perhaps the most startling awareness came after a class in visual perspective. After that class, I saw straight lines shooting everywhere, eaves continuing their lines into the sky, rooms developing a dizzying array of surfaces, angles, and corners. I was aware for the first time where everything was, what was in front of everything else, and how it related to where everything else was. And I sensed my place in the interdependent web of existence. People who receive their reality from creativity transmute this experience into a distinctive awareness. Reality moves through them and becomes another reality. American poet Wallace Stevens said, "Reality is not what it is. It consists of the many realities that can be made into." So this new reality became integral to my lifelong religious journey. Thankfully, the Unitarian Universalist faith supports a journey rather than requiring a destination, and it encourages exploring and thinking about one's own reality. Creative people and their statements about their process reflect the same three sources of awareness as the spiritual inspirations I find in religious liberal religions. First, the more traditional, one might say religious, consider the source of their creations to be outside of themselves, to come from a God, from a transcendental essence of the universe. Second, many people find their source to be within themselves, to come from an indwelling spiritual presence that they seek to find and honor. Like the people who make the often quoted statement, "I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual," they make this distinction. They find their own sense of immanence from intuitive inspiration. And third, many people in liberal religion find themselves outside of these religious or spiritual traditions. Their source is rational and humanist. They do not see their inspiration coming from a divine or an inner spirit, but from intellect, reason, and compassion. Now listen to the words of creators reflecting the same three sources. Handel composed Messiah in 24 days, an amazing act of creation. It is a monumental work, complex, long, rich. He must have been writing in a frenzy of awareness. How did he see it? In his own words, quote, "I thought I saw all heaven before me and the great God himself." Handel is telling us that he received awareness from outside of himself. About writing its best-known part, the Hallelujah Chorus, Handel said, "Whether I was in my body or out of my body, as I wrote it, I know not, God knows." These are profoundly religious statements. Then there is the great American dancer and choreographer Martha Graham, whose letter we read earlier. Graham told people that her dances had always existed. She only invoked them. And she did not choose to invoke them. She was chosen to invoke them. As she recorded in her notebooks, she had been given lonely, terrifying gifts, which were followed, as she said in the first reading, by a divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive. So Graham sensed a source outside of herself, a religious source. A spiritual source from within was cited by Ken Wilber in the readings when he said that one could sense a non-dual awareness from works of Zen art, the spiritual oneness of the creator and the created. He who cannot become an object cannot paint the object. Intuitive awareness is also a source of innocence, an openness to begin again, to see the world as though it were new and fresh. So listen to creative artists about their surprise at their awareness from within. Marcel Proust penned, "The real voyage of discovery consists not of seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes." The sculptor, Robert Kuhn, said, "I can't wait to experience the surprise of what my hand creates." Some of you may remember the Columbus sculptor John Freeman. His wife sang in this choir for a number of years. John said, "Why do I go to my studio? So I will be there for the next surprise." When my wife, Jo, read this talk, she said that these last two statements reflected her own experience. What surprise awaits her when she begins to create her abstracts, her collages? What new awareness will come from these? Members of the First Church Artist Group were challenged to create works in black and white for last fall's show. Each had to become aware of a world without color and create a work in black and white for the show. And they did, and the pieces were exciting, and each one was very different from the other. This openness quality of awareness is also expressed as the individual's ability to receive visionary creations from their subconscious. The American painter Edward Hopper wrote, "So much of every art is an expression of the subconscious that it seems to be most of all that the important qualities are put there subconsciously and little of importance by the conscious intellect." And finally, the third source, the famous writer Rod Serling, who was once a member of this congregation, said, "Take truth for authority, not authority for truth." I find this a reference to a distinctly humanist outlook, one which is dubious about revelation, but relies on intellect and reason. As for myself, when I was called upon to write a mission statement, I found it easy. I believe that excitement flows from every point in the universe, energy from the creation. I believe that the awareness that comes from creativity, we can perceive this excitement as beauty, as awe, as grandeur, as order, as ultimate reality. So I seek to become aware of places where this excitement can be seen and create works to transmit it to others. When I am asked, "Where do you get ideas?" I have to respond, "I don't get ideas. Ideas get me." It is as though they were outside myself, looking for a home, looking for someone who will give them expression. Once they inhabit me, I become their servant, not questioning the master, just committed to being their slave. I might classify this as a religious tradition. Or maybe it's inward, spiritual. Or as I struggle with figuring out how to get the effects I want, it's just plain human intellectual figuring. Perhaps it's all three. How very human, and what fun.